You've probably seen and heard a few stories over the years of the people who helped win the Second World War away from the front lines, the people who broke the codes of the Axis powers and kept our codes from being broken, contributed mightily to the war effort. But the story we'll tell in this hour involves neither people talking in the language of the Diné people nor Alan Turing. Instead, we'll talk about women, lots and lots of women, thousands of them. Their story is told in a recent book by Liza Mundy called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women code breakers of World War II. Liza Mundy writes about gender, politics, history, and culture. She worked for many years at the Washington Post and is now a fellow at the New America Think Tank. Her previous books include a biography of Michelle Obama. Liza Mundy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Had you known of the women code breakers for long?
No, I had not. Like most people, it was definitely an untold story, and I was I had read a little bit about it here and there, and I was at the cryptology museum that we have here in the D.C. area, a history of code breaking, and talking to some historians and curators there who laid out this story of thousands of women being recruited during World War II, and that came as a surprise to me, as I think it does to most people.
How well kept a secret were they at the time?
Well, it was a completely kept secret. The women were recruited to come work in Washington, D.C. at a couple of giant but top-secret code-breaking compounds. Their very first day, inevitably, they had to sign not only a loyalty oath but a secrecy oath. It was wartime, so the penalty for talking about a top-secret classified occupation would be death. It was considered treason. And after the war, they were told, thank you very much for your service. Please never talk about it. Definitely never talk about it. And so even when that was relaxed in the 80s and 90s, nobody told the women, nobody sought them out and told them that it was okay to talk, and they kept the secret, in most cases, all their lives. I interviewed 20 women for my book, and in some cases, I really had to pull the story out of them and convince that it was finally okay to tell their story, and or even to use certain terms that they had been told never to use outside the code-breaking compounds because it might tip off the enemy.
So did you contact some of them and ask for interviews and get the third degree back? How'd you find this number? Who are you?
Yes. I mean, sometimes I would usually they would know how I found them. In one woman who's the central character in my book, I found her via her son, who all his life had wanted to know exactly what his mother had done in Washington, D.C. And between the two of us, we sat there and it took us almost an hour to convince her that she wouldn't be put in prison if she talked. And other women, I found them various ways. It's sometimes cold calling. And some of them were actually quite eager to tell their story and justly ready to get some credit for what they did. But in some cases, they would say, well, you can come talk to me, but I'm not going to tell you anything. And I would, and it would take me a while, again, to convince them that it really is okay now to tell this story.
But Liza, some of this is still classified?
Well, some of the documents are still classified. During the course of researching it for 2 years or more than 2 years, I had to file a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests with the NSA, the National Security Agency, which is the descendant agency of our wartime code breaking. So there was still material from World War II that was classified that I had to get declassified. The NSA had done oral histories with at least 20 women over the years, some of whom went on to work for NSA after the war, and I had to file for those to be declassified. And there may still be additional information or histories that are classified. Sometimes it's hard to know because they don't tell you.
Huh. Okay. So, but so this takes us back in time now to the original documents, and this is really interesting. Letters began arriving in November of 1941, before Pearl Harbor. From whom to whom?
Right. So even before Pearl Harbor, which was a great intelligence failure and would really launch our code-breaking operations, but even before that, the U.S. Navy realized that it needed to significantly ramp up its intelligence gathering, and particularly its ability to crack enemy signals, particularly the Japanese Navy. And so it had been traditionally inclined to recruit male intelligence officers from the Ivy League. So knowing that it needed to ramp up its operations, the Navy began secretly contacting professors at the female equivalent of the Ivy League, because most Ivy League colleges weren't open to women at the time. So they approached the Seven Sisters, Radcliffe, Wellesley, Bryn Mawr, Smith, Mount Holyoke, and and asked for the professors to identify their top senior women, particularly in areas like languages and math. And those young women, to their great surprise, received letters inviting them to secret meetings where they would be asked two questions: do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And if they answered yes to the first and no to the second, they would be invited to embark on a top secret training course during the course of their senior year, and then come to Washington after their graduation to start breaking codes in earnest.
You mentioned that was the Navy. I should have figured the Army would get in there, too. Were there turf battles between the two services?
Yes, absolutely. There was a lot of competition. There was suddenly a lot of competition for educated women who up until then had pretty much been confined to school teaching as the one job occupation open to them. You know, law was closed off to women for the most part, medicine, architecture, engineering, all those fields. But during the war, that all changed, and private industry started recruiting for, you know, math majors who could program early computers, but the U.S. Army desperately needed a massive code-breaking force of its own to work on codes of the Japanese Army, Japanese diplomats, countries all over the world, Vichy France, and so they had a different recruiting strategy. The Army sent its handsomest young officers to post office and hotels throughout the South and the Midwest, specifically to recruit young school teachers, thinking that they would lure these young women to Washington with the hope of making a marriage to a handsome young military man. And a lot of these women got on the trains, number one, to serve the war effort, but also, in some cases, to strike out on their own.
We'll pick up the story on the other side of a break. The book is called Code Girls. Liza Mundy is the author and our guest. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Liza Mundy. She's written a book about women who helped break the codes of our enemies during World War II. The book is called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Questions, comments, maybe you know somebody who did this. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I realize this is very serious business at the time, Liza. There's a semi-comical, almost creepy tone to it, though, when asking these women in college, do you like crossword puzzles and are you engaged to be married?
Yes, I suppose it came as a great surprise to the women, and the marriage part was because I think two things. It was feared that if a woman was engaged to be married, that she would be a less reliable worker, less likely to persist in her training, either because she might relocate to accompany her husband to his training camp, or because she might become pregnant. And the thinking was still that when a woman became pregnant, it was her job to get out of the workplace. So they just thought that engaged women would not be the ideal worker in an environment where the women were working 24 hours a day. They were working three shifts, very stressful work, very urgent. They needed the women to be completely available to them. And in fact, many of these women at the Seven Sisters schools were engaged to be married. There was a big rush to the altar after Pearl Harbor, and many men wanted to have a fiancé waiting for them at home. And some of these women lied and said they weren't engaged because whatever they were being invited to do sounded much more interesting than waiting around for a couple of years to see if their boyfriend or their brothers or, you know, the men in their lives would be okay. They wanted to serve the war effort, but they also were quite intrigued by the invitation.
So let's back up a couple of steps and understand the work. I mean, codes for military operations, were they relatively recent developments in that time?
That's a great question. You know, certainly codes have been used in Europe since the Renaissance. I mean, diplomats would hide coded letters. Mary, Queen of Scots, used coded letters that were read by her cousin Elizabeth and exposed her. So codes existed, but our military had not used them a lot. Some during the Civil War and World War I, but the transmission systems tended to be slow, and so they weren't that useful in the heat of battle. But World War II was very different. World War II was a war where armies and navies were fighting around the globe. Top commanders needed to communicate with troops or sailors or U-boat captains who were thousands of miles away. So there were literally hundreds of code and cipher systems being used, being transmitted generally by radio through the airwaves every day. So it was incredibly important to be able to pluck those messages out of the air to understand what the enemy was planning or where the enemy was. In a big ocean like the Pacific, it was very difficult to find an enemy ship if you didn't have some kind of secret insight into where those ships were going to be.
So were, you mentioned that that usually they took males from Ivy League schools, and so were they just not available because they were off in the actual direct war effort on the front lines?
Exactly. The men, because it was really Pearl Harbor, the shocking surprise attack on Pearl Harbor that exposed our need to ramp up our intelligence gathering instantly and massively. And that was the exact moment when the men were shipping out. And some of these men would code break out there in the theater of battle, and these thousands of women would be doing it domestically, and the women were made up more than half of our code breaking force, but there were certainly men who were part of the effort also.
So let's meet some of these women. Tell us about Dorothy Braden and why she was chosen.
So Dot Braden, who's my central character and incidentally is still alive and well in outside Richmond, Virginia, she was a young school teacher teaching school in Chatham, Virginia on the North Carolina border. She was the oldest daughter in a family of four children. Her mother was supporting the family as a secretary in a uniform factory in Lynchburg, her hometown. She had gone to Randolph-Macon Woman's College in Lynchburg as a day student. Her family couldn't afford to board her, and she was teaching school in part to supplement her family income. She needed the money. She had two younger brothers who immediately enlisted in the Army, so they were already in the fighting or on their way, and she was completely overwhelmed by her teaching load her first year of teaching, which was very common. You know, all the male teachers had left for the fighting. A lot of the female teachers had left to marry the men. She was overwhelmed. She was making $900 a year. She came home and said, "Mom, I'm not going back to that job." Her mother said, "Well, there's some Army recruiters in the Virginia Hotel in Lynchburg recruiting for some kind of job with the War Department. Why don't you go see what that is?" So Dot applied. She gave them some references. She didn't realize it, but they instantly started checking her background and checking her references. She was accepted into a job. She didn't know what it was going to be. She took the train to Washington, D.C. for the first time in her life. She knew she'd be making $500 more than she had made teaching school, which was about a 50% raise. And within a month, she was trained to sync the to break the messages that were being used by the supply ships that were supplying the Japanese Army all around the Pacific, supplying them with food or fuel or oil or medicine or troops. And it was Tot and a group of school teachers who broke those codes that would provide the American submarine commanders with the intelligence they needed to know where the supply ships were. And it had a massive impact on the war in the Pacific.
Liza Mundy's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Did the military have any trepidation about hiring women, given the view in the culture at the time that, oh, women tell stories, blah, blah, blah?
Right, yeah. So there was one of the kind of stereotypes about women was that they couldn't keep a secret, you know, that women were gossips or that they would talk. And so that there was some concern about that, although I found a document. They were also concerned about young men in this regard, and they felt that young men were sometimes prone to drink and brag to women they wanted to impress. And so there was kind of a strike against each sex for a different reason. But the women proved their ability to keep a secret, and they were told that if anybody asked what they were doing in these giant top secret compounds in Washington, that they were to say that they were secretaries, that they sharpened pencils or emptied waste baskets or filled ink wells, that their work was unimportant. And because they were women, people believed them. And it's sad and ironic, but it made them in some ways the perfect intelligence officers, because people thought that their work couldn't possibly be that significant.
So you have your kind of decoys in that sense, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Why were so many people needed for code breaking? We're talking thousands of
women
here.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of that work would be done by computer today. And so the women were, they were running machines, they were running teletype machines, but they were doing sort of repetitive but complicated math often that could be done by a computer now. And so it did take thousands of people, and this was true in other fields like astronomy or early computing. It took, you know, thousands of people in some cases to do the complicated math that a computer would be doing now, or in some cases, in the case of the German naval codes that the U-boats were doing, were using the Enigma machines that people might have heard of if they've seen The Imitation Game. But in order, and we had machines that were breaking those codes, but they had to be programmed every day. And in those cases, women were designing early computer menus. So part of it was that there were literally hundreds of different code systems, but part of it was that they literally had to be the computers, the human computers in many cases.
Which is reminiscent of the characters in Hidden Figures. Which
exactly.
Is, yeah, the story of the women African-American computers who did all the work to help put people on the moon.
Right.
The work that they were doing, though, how do they divide the duties up? I mean, you mentioned that Dorothy Braden, Dot Braden, was responsible for monitoring ships in the South Pacific. So were they given geographical areas of domain, or how was it organized?
Yeah, it was organized by code system. So she was working this system. It was called the Water Transport Code, it was known as 2468. And so she and other school teachers were kind of an assembly line operation. This was a four-digit code system in which a word like supply ship, the Japanese word would be maru, or which was a commercial ship that had been commandeered for Army use, that might be rendered as a four-digit code group. So it might be like 6271. But then another four-digit group of numbers would be added to it by the Japanese encoder, so it would become enciphered. So this was an early form of encryption. And it would be Dot's job to strip out that encryption and to try to identify what the code group stood for. You know, did it stand for the number of troops, or did it stand for a port of origin or a port of destination or the name of the ship? And so she would push the message along as far as she could, and she would take it to a woman who was called the overlapper and would overlap a lot of messages coming from a lot of different women to try again and tease out the meaning of these code groups, which changed regularly. And then it would go to another woman who was called the reader, and she would push it along further. And then the intelligence would be written up in an intelligence report, and it would be transmitted to the military, and it would make its way to a submarine commander in this case. So these were assembly lines that were deliberately patterned after the American assembly line. The same assembly lines that were turning out tanks and bombers were being used in the code-breaking operations.
So a bunch of people are going to touch it, and you get a decent finished product that is worth something at the end.
Yes, and they had to learn to do it very fast. They had to learn to work very fast, because sometimes these messages would say where a specific ship was going to be at noon the next day, the exact position at noon. And they had to work the message in time to get that out to the submarine commander so that he could be waiting when the ship appeared at noon.
Wow, tough work and fast. The Work of Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Code Breakers of World War II, a book by Liza Mundy, longtime journalist who worked for many years at the Washington Post. She's now a fellow at the New America think tank in Washington. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Connie and Eugene. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for all your research on this project. My mother was a WAC in World War II, and all she would tell me was that she was assigned to Camp Ritchie and that she was a secretary. I eventually found out that it had something to do with intelligence. Is there a way to find out what the people who were in the services did with this project and what their status was as opposed to the civilian employees?
Yes, and I'm so glad you asked, because the in 1942, the military did create the WACs and the WAVES. And so many of the women doing this work would, in fact, be WAVES or WACs. Some of them remained civilians, but some of them were military women. And the WACs in particular were allowed to go overseas, and they were allowed to both to work domestically and in the South Pacific, both breaking messages and, in some cases, encoding our own military messages, which was also important intelligence work and also top secret. And if you go to my website, which is lizamundy.com, I have a page for codebreakers and families, and it explains how you could obtain your mother's or, you know, people's grandmothers or whatever, these military records. It's actually not that hard. And if you want to contact me then through my website, if you get the records, I can help you interpret them, like what her job might have been.
So, Connie, thanks for calling, and we hope you take a chance to go to LizaMundy.com and get that worked out. We should explain, too, for the facts that people who don't know the terms, I was explaining this to some younger office workers yesterday, WACS, Women's Army Corps, and WAVES were the that actually isn't an acronym, isn't it? It's just the Navy's name for...
It actually isn't an acronym. It was Women Accepted for Voluntary Emergency Service.
Oh, okay.
This was a big watershed moment for women in the military. This was when women were, you know, admitted in large numbers to the U.S. military. They proved their worth. The WACS certainly did. The WAVES did. The WASPs and SPARS and the Coast Guard. And women stayed. This is when women then continued to be a part of the U.S. military even after the war. So this was a really important, groundbreaking cohort of women.
So we invite you now, Liza, to take us off into the weeds. Codes and ciphers. These are not the same, apparently.
Yes. So the although sometimes they can be used together, as in the Japanese code system I was explaining. So a code is when a word is replaced by another unit. So again, a word like Maru or troops or the name of a ship would be replaced by a code group, often a 4 or 5 digit set of numbers. But enciphering is when a single letter is replaced by another letter. So one of the really important cipher systems that we were working was the Enigma cipher system. The Germans had this handy little machine called the Enigma that people have heard of if they've seen The Imitation Game. It looked like a typewriter, but its job was to scramble the letters in a German message over and over and over. It had a series of rotors. They would scramble, say, the letter A several times until it emerged maybe as G. The women who were working that system had to learn how to sort of master statistical, they had to learn how to do frequency counts and understand how many times a letter would appear in
like
normal German.
Like E shows up more than an E.
And then they had to design, they had to figure out what mathematical equation might be sort of underlying what they were seeing to figure out what the setting was for the rotors. And then they would program our big machines to try to sort of reverse engineer that process. So that's a cipher where one single unit is replaced by another. And the Japanese system I described earlier that the school teachers were breaking, that was both. That was called an enciphered code system. And so it gets complicated really quickly. But again, this was early encryption. So what these women were doing was essentially hacking. And this was the birth of cybersecurity.
So it's sort of like the Ovaltine, you know, junior spy ring where you just, you know, Z equals M for the day, that kind of thing is what
yeah.
the ciphers do.
Yeah. But that's how they would, like that training that the women got at the Seven Sister Schools, they were learning how to recognize, you know, certain letters that might have replaced other letters. They were learning how to take frequency counts.
So the ciphers in particular, I would think, would present some challenges because even once you've cracked what the letters are, you're still dealing with a language you might not know.
Exactly. And they had to learn a little bit of the language. Like the women who were working the Enigma codes, there's a lot of guessing involved in it. So they knew that the Germans had weather ships in the Bay of Biscay that would report back to the U-boats on weather conditions. So if a cipher came from a weather ship, they knew it might include the word Wetter, like W-E-T-T-R. That's not that hard to know that in German. And they could sort of position the message they were seeing that was scrambled and figure out where the word Wetter probably appeared in order to kind of do the math that they needed to do and figure out the setting. But then once they got a full message emerging in regular German from their reverse engineering process, they did have to have women who knew German who could actually translate those messages. And one of the most, to me, one of the most moving chapters in my book is when the women in the code-breaking operation are experiencing the D-Day landings from the point of view of the Germans who are reacting to the sight of all these Allied ships on the horizon and what's happening. The women are reading those messages, unscrambling them and then translating them. So they're experiencing what's happening from the point of view of the Germans.
So the Axis powers were certainly aware that the Allied powers were trying to break their codes. I don't know if they were aware of quite how robust the system was with all those quote-unquote secretaries. But so how did they respond or what did they change through the war?
Yeah. So the Japanese, it's never clear that the Japanese realized that we were breaking their codes. And we would do things like send up airplanes to make it look like we had spotted the supply ships from the air. But the Germans definitely did get suspicious and, you know, knew what we were doing. And, of course, they were doing the same thing to us or trying to. So what happened, again, if people have seen The Imitation Game, they knew of Alan Turing's great breakthrough when he figures out, you know, how to break these Enigma messages. But what the German Navy did, and the reasons the Americans had to get involved, was they became suspicious. They added an extra rotor to their Enigma machines in the U-boats that made it so that the British machines couldn't work this code anymore. And the Americans had to get involved because it had become much more complex. So the Germans did anticipate our efforts, and they did make changes that made it harder, that's what brought the Americans into the Enigma code-breaking project.
Okay, that's why they had to do work in addition to the folks at Bletchley Park and, Turing's group. Okay, Liza Mundy's our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Code Girls, about code breakers, women code breakers in World War II. We'll come back to the discussion, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we resume in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is longtime journalist Liza Mundy. She spent many years at the Washington Post, now is a fellow at the think tank New America in the Washington area. She's written a book about women breaking Axis codes for the Americans in the Second World War, a story that really wasn't known at the time. It's called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women code breakers of World War II. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Questions, comments, and maybe even relatives. We've heard from one woman already who thinks her mother might have been involved in that. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've mentioned just one person by name, Dorothy Braden, so far. There's another one in the book, Agnes Driscoll, who made some particular contributions. Tell us about her.
Agnes Driscoll was a genius and an incredibly important pioneer in code breaking. She was employed by the U.S. Navy as a civilian in the 1930s, back when code breaking in the Navy was not a prestigious occupation at that time. You know, men who were career officers in the Navy, they wanted to be at sea, they wanted to be commanding ships, and code breaking was just starting to be, you know, potentially a really important occupation, but it was seen as something that a woman who was a civilian might be suited for because she wouldn't have the sort of career opportunities that a man would. So anyway, Agnes Driscoll worked as a civilian for the Navy in Washington, diagnosing how the Japanese fleet code worked, the great fleet code that the Japanese used for all its important naval communications. And so she's the one who diagnosed that it was this thing called a super enciphered code system, in which words would be changed to sets of letters, numbers, but then the numbers would be further enciphered by adding more numbers to them. And they were constantly changing their code books and their cipher books, so the meaning of a code group would change, but the way it was enciphered stayed the same. She's the one who figured that out. She's the one who trained all the male naval officers who would then go out to the Pacific, and our first great code-breaking victory was the Battle of Midway, which is one of the most famous sea battles of all time. The Japanese had sent a huge flotilla to try and ambush us and knock us out of the Pacific 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and we broke the messages that said where they were headed. We ambushed them, and we won that battle, and that was the beginning of a turning point in the Pacific. And all those men who were out there doing that code breaking in the Pacific had been trained by Agnes Driscoll. And then that was the exact moment where all of this new group of women who had been recruited from the Seven Sisters were pouring into Washington. So Agnes Driscoll was the one who proved that women could do this work and who trained the men who would make that great breakthrough at the Battle of Midway. And her name, she's been largely forgotten to history. She got shouldered out of the way during the war by competitive male naval officers and has never gotten the credit that she did for really breaking the important ground and training the initial cohort of people.
Did she get much static from the men she was training? I mean, having to learn from a woman?
It was a weird combination. They felt that she was a genius. They viewed her as their secret weapon. They totally respected her abilities. Many of the officers who would go on to write memoirs years after World War II would mention her and would credit her for breakthroughs, but she never got a lot of ink. And nobody took an oral history of her, which was very disappointing to me. Doing my research, it's hard to find anything that she wrote herself. And so she gets sort of written out of history, but the men themselves did credit her. You know, it's like during World War II, there were many male aviators who were trained by women. Women ran link trainers, training the men to fly. The women weren't allowed to fly in combat. So I think, you know, the idea of being taught by a woman was familiar, you know, to many men. And so they didn't resent her. They respected her. But she just didn't get the credit she deserved in history.
Well, you know, obviously this is all about, you know, numbers and letters and trying to break codes and ciphers and that sort of thing. But there's obviously a real human result in all this. And you mentioned the Imitation Game about Alan Turing and the British attempt to defeat the Enigma machine the Germans used. There's a situation in that movie that depicts where information could have saved lives, but it could not be used because it would reveal that codes were broken. Did those things really happen in the lives of the women you talked to, or in any of these code breakers?
You know, I talked to some historians about that, and they really didn't feel as though if a situation where we had an important piece of information and lives were at stake, they really didn't feel that there would have been times in the war when we had a piece of information and didn't share it and allowed lives to be lost. So I don't know. I met with some skepticism about that. But what did happen is that the women would break messages. There was one woman, for example, who was the watch officer in the naval facility when a message was broken saying that her brother's ship out in the Pacific was the target of a kamikaze raid. And they did get that information out to naval intelligence, but there was nothing that could be done to protect his ship from a kamikaze raid. And in fact, his ship was sunk, and they broke that message also. And she assumed that he was dead. In his case, he did survive that. There were other women who were actually able to track the passage of their brothers' ships and know in some cases that their brothers were okay or their boyfriends were okay. So there, you know, the women knew that lives were at stake. They knew that the morale of the whole country would falter if a convoy was sunk. But whether or not they ever withheld information and permitted lives to be lost, that seems to me that's been kind of met with skepticism by some of the historians I talked to.
All right, so flip the focus around in the other direction, though. It's not just a matter of protecting your own people, but the fact that the information that you convey can lead to the deaths of other people. And I wonder how much that was discussed among the women code breakers and if they felt any remorse about that.
They definitely knew when that happened. And this, it was very interesting to talk to the women about their changing feelings about this. If a woman knew that her message that she had broken had sunk a Japanese ship or sunk a Japanese convoy, you know, it was wartime. This was our enemy. And so there would be a great deal of satisfaction. They would feel satisfied that they had done that. But sometimes later in life, once they, you know, grew older, had families of their own, they would find themselves meditating on, you know, the Japanese lives that had been lost, the young Japanese men who had died, the way that their families would have reacted to that news. So their feelings about the work that they did would change with time. And one of the other really dramatic examples of this was when the American code breaking told us the itinerary of Admiral Yamamoto, who was the mastermind of Pearl Harbor. He was the commander of the Japanese Navy. The women and men in the Pacific broke codes that gave us his exact itinerary during an inspection tour. He was shot out of the air by Army fighter planes, U.S. Army fighter planes, and cheering went up in the code-breaking compound in Washington, D.C. when that happened. So I would say there was great satisfaction at the time, and then, you know, feelings would change years later.
You mentioned the code-breaking compounds. I also want to hear about the places where they lived. You tell the story of Arlington Farms. What was that?
Arlington Farms was this massive, basically sort of barrack slash dorm that was built in Arlington to accommodate, again, these hundreds and thousands of young women who were getting off trains every day in Union Station, coming to Washington to do this code-breaking work and other war work, and who needed a place to stay. The whole landscape of Washington, D.C., and Arlington, Virginia, where I live, was absolutely transformed by women who were pouring into the city and needed a place to live. And for many of the women, most of them, this was the first time they had ever lived on their own, you know, had a room to themselves or lived in a group house with other women. It was they had come from either, you know, from living in families or being chaperoned in college. So it was a taste of freedom for the first time.
So then were, I mean, there obviously were things they could do in their off hours. They worked 8-hour shifts, as you mentioned, in three shifts, though. I mean, so these people were working 24 hours a day, or the work was going on around the clock, not that individual workers were. So they had free time. I mean, did they go out and get drinks or anything?
Yes. There was a lot of drinking. They had a great time. I mean, again, that's one of the ironies. They were always worried about the men in their lives, worried about the course of the war. It was not at all apparent that we were going to win. So they knew that the work was stressful and urgent, but then they would definitely let off steam in their off hours. And one of my favorite anecdotes, there was a group of Wellesley women who came down, and they were working something called the Inner Island Cipher, which the Japanese set up to communicate between islands. And this was a code system that changed every month. And these women were able to break into the key, the new key, at the beginning of every month, spend a couple of weeks, a week or so, honing their skills. But then they could sort of go on autopilot. And so they would have these massive parties with a lot of drinking in the middle of the month. And then they would have a couple of weeks to recover from their hangovers before they had to break back into the new key setting again. So they would literally time their parties according to the Japanese changing the key in the code system.
Wow, so definitely some need to blow off steam in the middle of all that. So then the war comes to an end, demobilization. People come back to a lot of more traditional things they did. You know, libraries have been written about the men coming home from the war and the stiff upper lipping of the things they saw and experienced. How did the women do in returning to post-war life?
Yeah, so somewhat the same thing, but experienced in a different way. The women were told, thank you very much for your service. Never tell anybody what you did. The Navy women were given a medal. They were told never to show it to anybody. I had trouble persuading them to show it to me. So, and they were encouraged, of course, American women were encouraged to get married, have babies, and American life could return to normal. And so, you know, many of the women were suddenly very isolated. They had been in group settings doing urgent, satisfying work. Now they were at home alone with little babies and no appliances, because American factories had been churning out weapons.
And tanks and all that stuff.
So they were wringing out diapers in bathtubs, and they were lonely. So a number of the women started writing to each other, and in some cases kept up these things called round-robin letters to each other for the rest of their lives. But other women were able to use the GI Bill and go on to get graduate educations when they were at least permitted into some graduate schools. I interviewed one woman who was she was shut out of architecture school because she was told that they had to keep the spots open for returning men. So it was a bit of a mixed bag for the women trying to use their GI Bill. And then there was a cohort of women who continued doing this work after the war into the Cold War and beyond. And in fact, the first group of top civilian pay grade workers at the NSA was a group of women who came out of World War II.
So what about the likes of Dorothy Braden? Did she go back to teaching for $75 a month?
No, she got married. She had children. She stayed best friends with her a fellow school teacher from Mississippi she had met during her work. They could obviously never talk about their work, but they shared their lives and remained friends to the point where their children actually thought that they were cousins. Their children thought that they were related to the children of the other woman because the two women remained so close, such fast friends. And the families are still friends to this day. But she did, like many of these women, interestingly, when her kids became teenagers, she did re-enter the workforce. She had liked working, and she continued really working for the rest of her life.
So the boy, the family members, though, and the amount of information they didn't have, and particularly you're talking about trying to just get some information out of some of the people you interviewed, the 20 women you interviewed who were still around. Was there a sense of relief that they could finally tell the story?
Yes, there was. And the women, I think, had finally figured out that code-breaking histories had been written, you know, that The Imitation Game is out there as a movie, that massive books about the Battle of Midway or Pacific code-breaking had been written, and that their role had really been neglected. They knew that now. And so once I persuaded them that it was okay to talk, and some of them really knew that already, they were very understandably eager to get some credit for what they had done. And in some cases, to see their names in print. And one of the women I interviewed explicitly said to me, I just hope that I live long enough to see your book published. Mm. These were women in their early to mid-90s, and she did. So yeah, they're very happy to finally, you know, again, like the African-American women mathematicians of Hidden Figures, to finally have their place in the history books.
You set the final question up perfectly then. Hidden Figures has become a movie. Is there any talk of Code Girls being taken on as one?
Yes, it has been optioned, actually, by the production company owned by Jim Parsons, who plays the NASA engineer in Hidden Figures. He found that a very, I think that was an important and moving experience for him, and he'd like to see more of these stories get out. So I'm optimistic about that process.
Is Jim Parsons the guy from Big Bang Theory?
Yes.
Okay, that Jim Parsons. All right.
Yep, well. Yep.
Congratulations on a book well done and a really rousing look at a really interesting period of history that has been very much undertold until now.
Well, thanks for this great conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Sure. Liza Mundy's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Thanks again, Liza.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, take care.